Good morning. Welcome to the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton, a welcoming Unitarian Universalist congregation. My name is Hector Constanzos, and I serve as chair of the membership committee. Cindy's not in the pulpit today. Nope, she's here. Everyone is invited to coffee hour in Fellowship Hall after the service. To get there, please exit the church through the door to my left, follow the hallway, and either take the elevator or the stairs, or just follow the crowd and you'll eventually find coffee hour. Child care is available during the service in the nursery. If the need arises anytime during the service, please feel free to take your child there where he or she will be well cared for. The nursery is located in the lower level of Fellowship Hall. Follow the smell of coffee and just go down one more flight. If this is your first time with us, we are very happy to have you here. Please sign one of our guest books, which are located in the vestibule, at the front entrance of the church, or at the visitor's table at coffee hour, so we can put you on our mailing list for our newsletters and announcements. And at this point, please remember to put your cell phones in church mode, and I'll turn it over to Cindy.
So I'm trying to remember what I learned in the first service. It's National Chewing Gum Day. I learned that. And it's, what was the?
Something about being nice to people.
Something about being nice to people. I don't remember how that goes, but I think you can do it anyway, right? So greet your neighbor. I didn't even need to do like that. You just settled right down anyway. Our opening words are by Gretchen Haley, written for this day. We believe you. Your stories held too long in secret and shame are safe here. You are safe here to grieve and rage and reckon and reconcile, return and restore. There is a place here for every piece of yourself. Bodies and spirits, voices and breath, broken and beautiful, bitter and still refusing to give up hope. In this autumn light, there remains a path for beginning again. Do not hold back your heartbreak or your joy, your vision for the world that is already and also not yet. Let every tender longing of your heart be an offering for this time and for this community, as we are building here already a new way. The will, the courage, the faith to be the leaders, the people, the parents, the friends, the citizens, our world, and we need now. The change begins now. Come, let us worship together. Please join me with these chalice lighting words printed in your order of service by Paul Sprecher. We light this chalice to kindle the fire of commitment to spreading our beloved faith, proclaiming the good news that all are worthy and all are welcome. May we carry this flame to all we encounter, letting our lives shine with its glow. Please rise in body or spirit for our opening hymn, Gather the Spirit, number 347, and we'll follow this with the covenant and affirmation if you'll remain standing.
Spirit, harvest the power.
Please join in our covenant. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. Our message for all ages today are a few short stories about universalists, told by different people. The first one is about John Murray. Anyone tell me who John Murray was? Not Peter. Right, first universalist minister in America. So this is a story about him told by the Reverend David Johnson. The quick and witty comeback was part of the Universalist preacher's stock in trade, judging from an anecdote about John Murray, founder of American Universalism. During one of Murray's sermons, a stone flew through the window of the church where he was preaching, presumably thrown by an opponent of the Universalist doctrine. Murray picked it up and said, "This argument may be substantial and weighty, but it is not convincing." Our second story is about Hosea Ballou. Who can tell me who Hosea Ballou was? Again, not Peter. Right, if you were here in the first service, that's cheating, right? Hosea Ballou was an early Universalist minister, and he was an itinerant preacher. He went around spreading the gospel of Universalism a lot, and he was well known for this, and people would get very excited when he was coming to a town, and they'd hold big rallies and sometimes debates between him and another minister. And that's how the Universalist Church in Acton, which is one of the two churches that merged to become FPC Stowe in Acton, got founded, was because Hosea Ballou came to Acton and preached, and people were stirred up with the fervor of Universalism and founded a church 2 years later. I mean, it takes a while to start a church. So this is as told by the Reverend Elizabeth Strong. With this event in his background, it isn't surprising that Ballou became an expert at thinking on his feet. As one of the denomination's many itinerant clergy, he was riding the circuit in the New Hampshire hills with a Baptist preacher one afternoon. They argued theology as they traveled. At one point, the Baptist looked over and said, "Brother Ballou, if I were a universalist and feared not the fires of hell, I could hit you over the head, steal your horse and saddle, and ride away, and I'd still go to heaven." And Hosea Ballou looked over at him and said, "If you were a universalist, the idea would never occur to you." And our last story is about Olympia Brown. Now, who can tell me who Olympia Brown was? First woman ordained. At least that's what we Universalists claim, because she was the first ordained by full denominational authority. The truth is the Congregationalists, who, like Unitarian Universalists, ordain people by the power of an individual church, had actually ordained someone first. So we carefully ignore our own polity in order to claim first status. Shh, don't tell anyone. Olympia Brown was the first woman ordained. And she didn't have an easy time of things. In fact, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who we know, the famous sage of Concord, was once talking with her and some others at tea at his cousin's house. He kept everyone entertained for most of the afternoon, and eventually the discussion moved to the right of women to vote, to suffrage. And this was a cause Olympia Brown was very invested in and well known for being involved in. And Emerson said to her, "But I'm puzzled to find that the women whose opinions I most value and respect are opposed to it." And he turned to Olympia Brown and said, "Have you not found this to be so?" And without missing a beat, she said, "I should not value the opinion of any woman who is opposed to woman suffrage."
A gasp of shock went up from the group, and she realized that she had spoken quickly and harshly, rather rashly perhaps, but she did not regret it because she knew she had spoken the truth. Thus ends our little vignettes of early Universalists this morning. Michelle, who is taking our lantern out with leading our children?
Actually, I am, because we only have two youth that are here today that are attending church. And I just want to send up a notice to any senior youth that wants to come and hear, if they wish, that you're welcome to stay, of course, to hear the sermon. But Margot Law is going to do, and Ken, whose last name I'm blanking on, I'm sorry, Ken, is going to do a presentation on Judaism to the middle schoolers today.
It's been a hard week for many people in our communities, and I was moved this week by a relative of mine who posted on Facebook that they had been to their UU church this past weekend, and that their minister had invited anyone who had told her own story, and then had invited anyone who was a victim of sexual violence to stand. And my relative stood and acknowledged his own history publicly for the first time ever because of the safe space that was created in that community. And as I was hearing your stories during Joys and Sorrows, I thought I'd like to give you that opportunity today to have a moment. And I'm going to invite you to stand if you yourself are a survivor of an act of sexual violence, or if someone in your immediate family or close by loved ones is a member, to stand for them in an act of silent witness. So I stand on behalf of my cousin, my uncle. With this cloud of witnesses, I share this meditation or prayer by the Reverend Lisa Bovey Kemper. It has been a difficult week in the news, and as always, we have silent personal struggles in the midst of everything else. I invite you into the spirit of prayer. Holy One, we call by many names and sometimes by no name at all. There is a space between our breaths where we find the still small voice within. Let us seek together that place of calm. For anyone who has experienced sexual assault or harassment, you are loved beyond measure. You are good, right, and beautiful. Your lives are more than the sum of the moment or moments that changed you. Whether the violation occurred yesterday or decades ago, may you find ears to listen, hearts to believe your story, and may gentle hands reach out to clasp yours in solidarity and support. You may be seated. For female-identified people and others with female reproductive organs, your agency is paramount, your health should never be compromised, and your body is not disposable. For leaders and holders of power across this country, may your eyes be clear, may your hearts remain open, and may your resistance to the status quo be fierce. For anyone who is wrestling silently with personal demons or challenging situations that are out of your control, may you be held in the embrace of the Most Holy. May you find ways to be empowered, and may you find comfort in the fullness of time.
May this community hold us a calm place in this storm. May we each strive to be the hands that gently reach out and the fists that rise in solidarity, fierce and strong. May it ever be so. Amen, and blessed be. Amen, and blessed be. One of the many things this church does is engage in the work of justice. We do this through our plate sharing. We do it through sometimes worship. We do it through events in the community. We do it through direct community action. And between the services today, we held a forum to talk about the upcoming ballot initiative that is designed to repeal rights for transgender people. After the service today, there's going to be a social justice council meeting. There are many other events that we're engaged in the work of this church and this community, this state and this world. In this spirit, so that the work of this church may continue, we will now take the morning offering. Our reading today is by the aforementioned Olympia Brown, and if it sounds familiar, that's because it's one of the responsive readings in our gray hymnal. Stand by this faith. Work for it and sacrifice for it. There is nothing in all the world so important as to be loyal to this faith, which has placed before us the loftiest of ideals, which has comforted us in sorrow, strengthened us for noble duty, and made the world beautiful. Do not demand immediate results, but rejoice that we are worthy to be entrusted with this great message, that you are strong enough to work for a great true principle without counting the cost. Go on finding ever new applications of these truths and new enjoyment in their contemplation. Thus ends the reading. Our next hymn is number 1053. It's in your teal hymnal, How Could Anyone Ever Tell You? And I invite you, rather than singing it facing forward today, to sing it to one another. Please stand in body or in spirit. So in 1961, two faiths came together to make Unitarian Universalism, and two churches came together about that time to make the First Parish Church of Stowe and Acton. The Acton Church was the Universalist Church, founded after the early Universalist preacher, as I said, Hosea Ballou, came up to Acton to stir up some interest in Universalism in 1814. Universalism in the beginning was the no-hell church, a church that believed in universal salvation. And Hosea Ballou was known for many witty exchanges on the idea and was a renowned public speaker. Universalism was a controversial idea in those days of puritanical dogmatism and damnation and the hellfire and brimstone of the preaching of the time. And universalism was not uncontroversial. It was very controversial. There was controversy within Universalism as well between Hosea Ballou's ultra-universalism, that everyone saved right away, and the restorationist Universalism of John Murray, which says some people have some work to do first. I could go more into what that was all about, but I'll save that for some other day and refer you to historical volumes on Universalism if you're interested. Or you can come to the Journey of UUism class that we're offering in October, where we're going to go over UU history a bit more. Today I want to move rather quickly from the historical roots of what Universalism meant into what it later became, and then what I think the potential is for it to become still today. It's a long way from our early Universalist roots to the Universalism that was ready to merge with a more humanistic Unitarianism in the 1960s. A major turning point for that happened in the 1940s when a new idea started to emerge in Universalism, just as the humanistic movement was emerging in Unitarianism. At the 1943 General Assembly, the General Superintendent of the Universalist Church of America, Robert Cummins, addressed the gathered assembly and said this: Universalism cannot be limited either to Protestantism or to Christianity, not without denying its very name. Ours is a world fellowship, not just a Christian sect. For so long as universalism is universalism and not partialism, the fellowship bearing its name must succeed in making it unmistakably clear that all are welcome, theist and humanist, Unitarian and Trinitarian. A circumscribed universalism is unthinkable. Shortly after this, in 1944, the Federal Council of Churches, this is the National Association of Christian Churches, rejected the Universalist Church of America's application to join their organization. While the Congregationalists and the Quakers and the AME and three other denominations voted for us, we were not Christian enough to suit the other 12 denominations in the organization. 2 years later, the Universalists applied again and were rejected again as not Christian enough. Following up on that, in 1946, Tracy Pullman, the minister of the Universalist Church in Detroit, preached a sermon which called Universalism to become a new religion, quote, greater than Christianity, because it is an evolutionary religion, because it is universal rather than partial, because it is at one with the spirit of science and primarily interested in bringing out that which is godlike in humanity. Actually, he said in man, but I'm editing. This wave of thought was growing in Universalism. Also around that time, Brainerd Gibbons, the minister in Wausau, Wisconsin, asked in a sermon, is Universalism a Christian denomination, or is it something more, a truly universal religion? This issue is the most vital Universalism has ever faced, he said, striking at the very base of its religious foundation. For Christianity and this larger Universalism are irreconcilable. A momentous decision must be made, and soon. So this is the atmosphere in Universalism that existed when in 1947, the Massachusetts State Convention of Universalists starts their big new experiment, the Charles Street Meeting House. You've heard of the Charles Street Meeting House? This was to be a church dedicated to the task of creating the universal religion that it was dreamed Universalism would become. Kenneth Patton was its first minister. The Reverend David Bumbaugh writes, the Massachusetts Convention of Universalists created Charles Street Meeting House and charged Kenneth Patton with establishing a liberal church in the bastion of conservative Unitarianism and creating new liturgical forms appropriate to a religion for one world. In these ways, the Universalists, smarting at their rejection by mainline Protestantism, stunned by their catastrophic decline, and driven to redefine their gospel in relation to a new and more complex world, entered into a prolonged and deliberate period of self-examination, redefinition, and theological discernment. Bumbaugh continues, this process, which formed the background of some of the debates around the question of consolidation, was still unfinished at the time of consolidation of the Universalist Church of America and the American Unitarian Association in 1961. And it is this unfinished business that is the critical legacy of Universalism to the subsequent movement. The Charles Street Meeting House was a church in Boston, and it was originally a Baptist church, and an important spot on the abolitionist history. It's a stop on the Black Heritage Tour now. When it became a Universalist church, it was redecorated to reflect this new concept of universal religion. In it, a map of the world could be found on the floor at the center of the sanctuary, and a picture of a swirling galaxy of stars under the proscenium arch at one end of the sanctuary, and a picture of an atom at the other end. Symbols of world religions and religious and secular symbols of all types were made into bronze figures about yay so that adorned the sanctuary. As minister of the Charles Street Meeting House for 15 years, Kenneth Patton wrote prolifically, producing numerous volumes of readings and hymns. The Universalist and Unitarian Universalist hymnals that followed were packed full of his writings, and he served on the hymn book commission for the first hymn book after our merger, thus shaping our denomination and our theology through song and story. David Bumbaugh says of Patton, It was he who taught a monotone rationalism how to sing. It was he who taught a stumble-footed humanism how to dance. It was he who cried, "Look," and taught our eyes to see the glory in the ordinary. Ultimately, the Charles Street Meeting House did not thrive. In fact, even the Massachusetts Convention, which had started the project, refused ultimately to allow the church into membership with them because they thought it's not really Universalist. When Patton left the church in 1964, the church went into decline, losing members until they finally closed in 1970. So, as David Bumboff said, it is this unfinished business that is the critical legacy of Universalism to the subsequent movement. Why did this vision of universal religion fail? Is it still a valuable dream to have for our future? I think that one thing that happened in our culture in the 60s, 70s, and decades beyond that affected this dream of universal religion was the shift from modernism to postmodernism. So, for example, in the modernist viewpoint, we hold the view that the country should be a melting pot. Anyone else hear Schoolhouse Rock singing in their head when I say that? Children of the 70s, yes, we are. The melting pot idea is that idea that everyone comes to this country and melts right in. You no longer stand out as a potato or tomato. You've melted in. It's all one big stew. Everything assimilates into the larger culture. Everything becomes part of the great homogeny of Americanism. When postmodernism came in, the ideal changed from a melting pot to a salad bowl, or you could pick other metaphors if you want. That's part of postmodernism, right? But when you think of the salad bowl idea, it's an America where the carrot and the cucumber retain their separate identity despite being part of the same dish. The carrot shares its cultural carrot history, and the cucumber has its cultural cucumber history, and yet they're still part of the salad bowl of America. The postmodern view embraces diversity and honors the inherent goodness in all people by saying that their culture and their identity and their religion is valuable and good. When you apply this concept to religion, it argues, why should there be one universal religion? It's okay, even good, for there to be a multitude of religions. Why should there be a one-size-fits-all theology? And this is where Unitarian Universalism went as a movement. There are many paths up the same mountain, we sometimes say. Or I say, there are many paths up many different mountains, and they all have great views. So if we've moved theologically from that early no-hell universalism, and we've moved on from the uncircumscribed universalism, universal religion universalism, what can universalism mean for our future? I think the biggest remnant of early universalism that is evident in our movement today is in our first principle in Unitarian Universalism, the belief in the inherent worth and dignity of every person. That's where I find the universalist spirit today. It's there in the work that we do for the marginalized and the oppressed. What universalism today means to me is that you are all welcome here. Whatever your religion, whatever your sexual orientation, whatever the color of your skin, you are holy, you are whole, you are good. How could anyone ever tell you otherwise? Universalism to me means countering white supremacy and countering toxic patriarchy and doing the hard work of partnering with those who seem most different from ourselves. Universalism today means embracing diversity, both outside and inside our walls. I listened to the Kavanaugh hearings this week, and I spent some time talking with someone I know, someone who doesn't believe Christine Blasey Ford and believes Brett Kavanaugh. And I struggled with that perspective. How does someone listen to the same things I listen to and come away with such a different perception of where truth lies? And it was particularly confusing to me because the person I was talking to was a woman. And I thought about how it is for some people that authority rests outside ourselves. And theologically, sometimes that means authority rests with an institution like in the Catholic Church, it rests with the Pope. Sometimes that authority rests with God. And it's such a Unitarianism ideal to say that we have internal authority. And for some people, authority rests specifically with men. Given a story of a woman who says something and a man who says the opposite, the man is inherently more trustworthy for some people because he's a man. That's patriarchy. Men are inherently more credible. It made me think about the instances we've seen in the last years of black men who were killed by law enforcement and how over and over again the court system believes a white officer when they say, I had probable cause, I had reasonable suspicion, I had a reasonable sense of danger. That's white supremacy, the idea that white people are inherently more credible because of the color of their skin. It's normative. These things are normative, and anything else is other. The universalism that I think we need today is a universalism that breaks down the systems of patriarchy and white supremacy and other systems of oppression, and which believes survivors and victims. Making this shift part of our religious culture might feel like at first that it goes against a strong grain that's also within our religious culture, our inherent skepticism, our desire to question everything, to listen to all sides and to get to the bottom of the truth personally and decide for ourselves. But a great article in The Humanist by Greta Christina makes this point. There's a basic principle of rationalism, she said. When you hear hoofbeats, look for horses before zebras. Assuming you live someplace zebras are rare, of course. In medicine, it means that you should look for a more common diagnosis rather than a rare one, unless you have a compelling reason not to. Here, skepticism and rationalism go hand in hand. Rare events occur, of course, and shouldn't be entirely rejected, but we shouldn't look for rare, convoluted explanations when common and simple ones are staring us in the face. This is what she says. False accusations are the zebra. Sexual assault is this distressingly common horse. So that's the good news, I guess. Believing victims doesn't go against our rationalism at all. In the era of Hosea Ballou, I think our country needed his ultra-universalism. We needed a theology that moved us away from fire and brimstone and the fire and the damnation of hell to a theology that had a vision of God as a loving father, someone who would never condemn his children to the pits of hell. In the days of Kenneth Patton, we needed a universal religion universalism in a world that was fractured by war. We needed something that was uniting people across the earth and understanding our common humanity. Today, we need a universalism that says to the oppressed, you are loved, you are worthy, you are holy, you are whole, you are welcome here. And how could anyone ever tell you that you are anything less than beautiful? How could anyone ever tell you you are less than whole? That's the whole of universalism today. I want to close with the words of Olympia Brown from 1820. She said, we talk of reforms. We have hoped to make the world safe from democracy, to establish a league of peace, safe for democracy, to establish a league of peace. The foundation of democracy is the realization that every human being is entitled to the opportunities of life, worthy of respect, and requiring an atmosphere of justice and liberty. This is the work that universalists are appointed to do. Universalists, sometime, somehow, somewhere, must ever teach this great lesson. We are not alone. We shall speak the language of universal love, and it will be heard, and the message will be carried far and wide. Indeed, may the message of universal love be carried far and wide. Our closing hymn is number 131, Love Will Guide Us. Please stand if you want to stand. Our closing words are by Carl Seberg. Through our temporary lives, the great currents of history run. Let us keep the channels open and free, so not to obstruct purposes greater than our own. Let us keep our minds set upon the high goals that here bind us into one sharing fellowship of loving hearts. Amen.